Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
7 years ago, the streets of Iraq were quiet. People went about their daily lives in Baghdad as they had for years. They didn't know the next day would be very different than any other.
Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures, and we will accept no outcome but victory.
They cheered when Saddam's statue came down, rejoiced again when he was captured. Iraqis don't want the Hussein government back. But for 7 years, Iraq has been struggling to return to the normalcy of March 18th, 2003. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, March 18th. And you know, John, with all the conflicting reports that have come out of Iraq, you never know if you have the real picture.
Well,
what's going on there?
There are only two U.S. wars longer than the war in Iraq. We're certain about that. You know what they are?
They are Vietnam.
Yep.
And Korea.
Afghanistan. Isn't that interesting? Let's get a check of the top morning news stories. House Democrats continue to hunt for enough votes to pass health care reform this morning. They are reportedly about 10 votes shy, but picked up two more yesterday, including Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, the first lawmaker to change his vote from no to yes. The bill will be formally released today with a Congressional Budget Office estimate due shortly thereafter. Some last-minute snags have pushed back the expected vote until Sunday. President Obama tells Fox News he likes the momentum he's seeing.
I'm confident we'll pass. And the reason I'm confident that it's going to pass is because it's the right thing to do.
Later this morning, the president will sign a jobs bill into law. We'll have more about that in a moment.
The Taliban are waging a campaign of intimidation in the Afghan city of Marja. Our partner, The New York Times, reports their tactics include at least one beheading and several attacks against residents who cooperated with Afghan forces. General Stanley McChrystal says the Taliban is trying to undermine NATO's chances of establishing a strong local government.
It's going to be a significantly long process. And there will be military challenges to that in the months ahead as the insurgents try to prove that we can't maintain enough security to do that.
Marj is thought to be a template for a similar campaign in the coming months in the neighboring Kandahar province. More now on this week's seventh anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq. We're joined by Waria Salehi, president of the Salehi Group, a company that is involved in Iraqi reconstruction. Waria, you moved back just after the invasion in 2003 with high hopes. Do you feel like those hopes were justified?
Not 100%. I would not say so. I would expect more to happen, but indeed not.
In 7 years, it's been a little bit slow. How has the country changed since that day?
Well, there's a lot of positive changes. I don't want to be negative all about it. I'll just give you one example. For example, open media and access to information, what's happening in the world and within Iraq. This was available 2003 and prior to 2003. Now everybody can open their TVs or check their emails or internet, and they could find all information, and they have access to all kind of information. So this is, I think, it's a positive step.
Okay, we're going to ask you about some of the other changes in a moment. Waria Salehi, stay with us.
Senior U.S. official says a missile strike last week killed an al-Qaeda leader linked to the December bombing of a CIA post in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Moscow this morning. She's hoping to push a long-delayed arms control pact across the finish line.
And checking in on the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are mixed. The Dow is now at its highest point in 18 months. It starts at 10,733. The S&P at 1,166. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,389.
Talking about health care reform this morning, the American middle class is apparently losing health coverage faster than the rich or poor, according to a new study. It costs more to get treatment. People are saying, you know, I can't afford it. Would you skip a dental checkup but shell out for minor surgery? Give us a sense of your priority list on health care. Tell us the story at 877-8MYTAKE, or you can go to our site, thetakeaway.org, and we're going to talk more about the Robert Wood Johnson study in about a half hour.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
It's almost 7 years since the United States-led invasion of Iraq began, and the country is now awaiting the results of the March 7th parliamentary election. We felt it was a good time to check in with Iraqis on the state of their country and how far it's come in the past 7 years. We're joined again by Waria Salehi. He's with us from Kirkuk. He's president of the Salehi Group, a company involved in reconstruction in Iraq. And also Lubna Naji joins us from Baghdad this morning, a 24-year-old medical student at Baghdad Medical School. Good morning. Lubna, you were a teenager 7 years ago when the invasion began. I'm wondering if you could kind of compare that day before, the feeling in Iraq before the invasion, and what it's like now.
Well, look, you know, at the beginning of, you know, the invasion, you know, we had, you know, as young people, we had such great hopes for the future of our country. We thought that Iraq is going to be like a prosperous, you know, peaceful nation, powerful nation, and that we are going to get rid from one of the most evil dictators on the face of Earth, who's Saddam Hussein, as you know. But the problem is that, you know, there has been lots of disappointments, you know, over the way. But I can tell you that the mood at the moment is much better than it used to be before in 2006 and 2007. There is much hope. There is much faith in the future. But there is still a lot to be done and a lot of unsolved problems that's going to make such, you know. So it's kind of difficult to compare, if you ask me to compare the period under Saddam Hussein to the time period under the invasion. But I can tell you that, you know, if there's one thing that I would miss about the time period of Saddam Hussein, is the element of, you know, stability and predictability. Life used to be very bad under Saddam Hussein, but at least, you know, life used to be stable, you know, things used to be predictable. But after the invasion, life, you know, has become bad as well. But the problem is that there is the element of surprise. And, you know, most of the time, the surprise is wearing good. You know, you would hear that a loved one of yours, you know, has been either killed or, you know, injured or, you know, has received threats or whatever. So the element, we lost the element of stability and predictability. That's the problem that we used to suffer from. But I can tell you that things at the moment are a little bit better than they used to be before. But as I said, there's still a lot that must be done. Yes.
Okay, Waria Salehi, you actually, things are bad enough in Iraq that you left the country and came to the United States and returned after the invasion. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you started a nonprofit which does microfinancing projects for business people in Iraq now.
Yeah, actually for poor people who have no access to conventional funds or the banks.
So with your clients that come in to get financing for their businesses, what kind of sense do you get from them? Do you get the sense from, as you heard from Lubna, that there's less stability but a better country now?
Well, yes, to be fair, there is less stability, but it's better country, and people like us, we believe that the country has a chance to become a good country down the road, when at the time, prior to 2003, there was no such a feeling or chance for Iraq ever transformed to an open society, open market, and open media, and so on. So we have a chance, but also, to be fair, in past 7 years, a lot of more progress should have been done, which has not been done, in my view. The government could be more transparent and more institutional rather than a lot of corruption and so on.
So you were in the United States for a while, and you've had a chance to see the elections as they work here and the election as it worked in Iraq recently. Do you feel like there's a burgeoning, fair democracy there in Iraq, your own version there in your country?
I think this one was much better if you compare them and use them as a measurement to the last one. This one was much fairer than the past one. However, this is there's no way to compare the Iraqi elections, which was happened 2 weeks ago, to U.S. elections because there's a lot of mismanagement, no systems in place, and to some extent there is corruption and playing with ballots and playing with people's votes. But I think if I personally compare to the last one, I think there's a bit of progress, and we are going toward hopefully open and fair elections.
Okay, that's Waria Salehi. He is the president of the Salehi Group that's working on microfinancing projects for low-income people in Iraq. And we also spoke with Lubna Naji, a 24-year-old medical student at Baghdad Medical School. Let's turn now to Adele Darwish, a British author and journalist. Adele, we just heard some kind of frustrated optimism from two people who are living in Iraq. Is that kind of typical coming out of these elections?
Yes, it's actually a typical comment. I mean, as for Lubna, she's a very bright, actually, student. She corresponded with everyone on Facebook. Obviously, she was too young to remember the bad days of Saddam. But something interesting, the predictability element and the stability under Saddam, life was predictable. It was bad, but predictable. They can calculate what happened every day. But in the general, larger picture, Iraq now is a democracy. There's only two nations in the Middle East who actually can claim they have a Western-style democracy where they can change the government through the ballot box, not through a military coup or interference of biology that the ruler would die after ruling 50 years. It's Israel and Iraq. And the improvement here, that there's maturity in the way the Iraqi are voting. But there's another type of frustration, the inability of the two larger groups, the one led by incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his opponent Iyad Alawi, who's a much better and more seasoned politician, there's be a inability of either of them to have a decisive coalition government that can implement policy. The problem with coalition government is a stagnation and policy is difficult to implement.
Okay, so you also sound like you have some sort of frustrated optimism.
For instance, optimism, they are moving to democracy. Once they repair the electoral system, make a constituency system instead of proportional representation, I think it would be much, much, much better and it would be perhaps the best democratically ruled country in the Middle East.
Okay, Adele Darwish, British author and journalist who specializes in Middle East politics, joined us from London. Thank you so much. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the top stories.
Signs this morning that President Obama's health care reform legislation is picking up more support. Congressman Dennis Kucinich initially voted against the bill because it didn't include a public option. But now he says,
I've decided to cast a vote in favor of the legislation.
Kucinich, speaking yesterday, is the first lawmaker to change his vote from a no to a yes. And President Obama tells Fox News, ultimately Congress will be held accountable for the outcome of the health care vote.
Somebody who votes for this bill, they're going to be judged at the polls. And the same is going to be true if they vote against it.
Overseas now, drone strikes in Pakistan's border region have driven al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders deeper into hiding. That's according to CIA Director Leon Panetta, who tells The Washington Post the attacks, quote, have them on the run.
A joyful reunion in Haiti. Nearly all of the 33 children who were given to American missionaries about 6 weeks ago have been returned to their families now. Nigeria's acting president dissolved the government yesterday, purging top officials loyal to the nation's sick president. It was his first major act since taking office more than a month ago. And finally, rock musician Alex Chilton has died.
It's so hard in times like now to hold on.
Chilton was known for his role in the band's Big Star and the Box Top. He started out as a teen vocalist in the 1960s. He died after suffering from heart problems in New Orleans yesterday. He was 59. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, how much do you make in a year?
We went from $130,000 a year to $60,000.
We continue our series on the DIY bailout by talking why Sai, it's so hard to talk about finances.
Yo!
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
To go, yes, because it's a Capitol Hill good news takeout that begins this segment. Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The Senate has cleared an $18 billion jobs bill. There's bipartisan support. The president is expected to sign it, but $18 billion, Todd, feels like a drop in the bucket to me. I don't know.
Yeah, for the size of the unemployment problem that we have, you know, kind of is. Not to mention the fact that, John, this Senate bill did pass. It is ready to go to the president. They're calling it a jobs bill, and it is that. But, you know, they have some tax credits for new hiring. If you hire somebody who is previously unemployed, they have some money for highway funds to spur highway projects, some payroll tax relief, which is all a positive. There's a question, though, about how much new job creation this leads to, because it doesn't do anything to stoke demand. You know, it's one thing.
Unless, let's look at the one piece. Yeah. I mean, the centerpiece is the whole thing about saying to employers, we'll give you a break from your Social Security taxes. That's the FICA thing, right?
Right?
We'll give
right.
you a break from that if you can show that you hired people, right?
Right.
How many people
yeah.
are going to do that? We have no idea, right?
Right. We have no idea. And a lot of employers sort of, you know, you're reading out in the press and hearing from a couple people on the Hill and senators who weren't terribly thrilled with this bill, saying, yeah, it's one thing to give the tax break, but, you know, if you make, you know, your doorknob making business, if there's not any new demand for doorknob, if there's not
right.
any new clamoring for doorknobs, the tax break doesn't do a whole lot. Thanks for the tax break, but why would I hire if I'm not selling any more doorknobs?
In a recession where demand is depressed, you need direct job support more than these kinds of incentives. That's the economic argument there, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And you need something to stoke demand. You know, highway projects may do that because once the building starts, you got to hire to do the building. The other stuff, a little questionable about actual job creation.
What's the political fallout from this? I mean, it seems to me, you know, a year ago, trillions of dollars, you know, tens of billions of dollars going to the banks, but only $18 billion for jobs. Does that come back to haunt lawmakers, Republican or Democrat?
I don't think so, because the demand now from the public, or at least as it's perceived on Capitol Hill, is for less spending, not more, John. But also on the job creation front, this is supposed to be only one in a whole series of jobs packages. Democrats are promising there will be many, many job creation efforts in succession. They feel like they can't do anything really big all at once right now because
cost containment is the issue. Right.
And that's hue and cry from too much spending.
And that's the whole issue with the Congressional Budget Office. I mean, going over to health care reform for a moment, the Congressional Budget Office is going to issue its report on how much the health care reform bill in the House is going to cost. And that's critical to the passage. What kind of a number are they looking for?
Well, people are dying for that number right now. They're supposed to get it last night, and it didn't come out. And when I say dying for the number, it's because there's a new scheduling crunch. When that number comes out, there will be a starting gun of 72 hours. Uh-huh. Right now, the healthcare bill will be voted Sunday at the earliest. We don't know exactly how big, but Democrats need to have that number under $1 trillion. In fact, they'd like it closer to $900 billion, of course, all paid for over 10 years, they say. And it's not just the number. It's also the policy that we're going to see. You know, who gets more help under this bill? What happens to the Medicare donut hole for grandma and grandpa's prescription drug costs? You know, all that stuff will be in there when we finally get it. Then they can start the clock to have a vote. Well, we're working Sunday, I'm sorry to say, but that's the way it is.
And Dennis Kucinich of the dark hair and leftist outlook is voting for this. He changed his vote. Is he low-hanging fruit or sign of a trend?
I think the former. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of feeling in the Democratic caucus that Kucinich's decision to flip from no to yes sent a lot of shockwaves or even ripples through the Democratic caucus. They have still a lot of heavy lifting with moderates and conservatives. He was low-hanging fruit.
All right, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, watching health care reform and everything else on Capitol Hill.
And now to our listeners for the next takeout. The big banks got a bailout from the government, and we're giving you a tips on how to bail out yourself, part of our 10-part series, DIY Bailout with contributor Beth Kobliner. But like the first step in any 10-step program, we focus on how to admit you have a problem. Why is it so hard? Well, we're only doing 10.
Well, in a recession, it's 10
Yeah,
steps.
We've condensed.
Right, there we go.
So why is it so hard to talk about money?
I'm calling from Jones Island, South Carolina. My name's Annie. I lost my job at the end of December 2009, and my husband took a pay cut at the same time. We worked for the same firm. We went from $130,000 a year to $60,000 a year. It's been a good challenge, but we're up for it.
That is a huge change. Candor. Laura Candor. In Colorado posts to our site, thetakeaway.org, we are deeply in debt, and since my husband has a hands-off approach to our finances, I feel I'm responsible for it all. I always feel like the bad guy when I tell anyone in the household that we cannot buy something or go somewhere.
Ricardo from Oklahoma City tells us why he thinks finances are a taboo topic. He says, could it be because we measure success based on financial wealth? If we don't have enough, we're not considered successful. If we make too much, we let people know, just not exactly how much.
You can take part, share your story, be part of our series DIY Bailout on our website, thetakeaway.org. Next Wednesday, we'll have part two for you. How do you set a list of priorities when you're trying to get yourself out of debt? If you have a success story or anything else, share it with us at thetakeaway.org or call 877-8-MY-TAKE.
What do you pay first? What do you let wait?
Right.
We have strategies for you, and we want to hear yours. Also on our site, you can catch up on all of our census coverage. Later this morning, we're going to talk about how the government defines race and how
the possibility of the person being able to decide is something new.
That's right. It used to be the census determined what race you were. That's Nell Irvin Painter, author of The History of White People. We'll hear more from her later this morning. And if you've got a census story, tell us.
Hi, this is Derek from Oklahoma City. And when my wife opened up the census in the mailer, she sat down, started filling it out, and singing the national anthem. And then asked me if she was weird. So, I don't know. You tell me.
She's fabulous. We love her. Derek, thanks for calling. We'll have our listeners do that for us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But when you fill out your census form, what are you thinking? Why are they asking me this? Give us your census critique, if you like, at 877-8-MY-TAKE and see other stories at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, if you're keeping score, folks, middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance coverage faster than the rich or the poor. If you lose coverage, what class are you in? We're going to talk about how serious it is to lose your health care coverage and the studies of the U.S. economy that show just how serious a situation this is. And first, we're going to talk about some top stories at about 30 minutes after the hour. The health care battle may be coming to a head on the national level this week, but it's just getting started at the state level. Idaho's Republican governor has signed a measure requiring his attorney general to sue the federal government if Congress passes the health care reform bill. 37 other states have similar legislation pending, but legal experts say the move is largely symbolic. Back to the fight on Capitol Hill, where President Obama tells Fox News using reconciliation to pass a bill isn't really controversial.
Washington gets very concerned about these procedural issues in Congress. This is always an issue that's whether Republicans are in charge or Democrats in charge.
Later today, the president will sign a jobs bill in a Rose Garden ceremony. The package includes tax breaks for businesses that hire unemployed workers.
And speaking of taxes, more and more people are doing them themselves in order to save money these days. USA Today is reporting that more people are filling their own forms in this year, with companies like H&R Block seeing double-digit declines in traffic from the same time a year ago. And he's not exactly Don Corleone. Italian police have been seeking a mafia hitman who calls himself Scarface for more than a year, but he is behind bars this morning. Turns out he was addicted to Facebook. He logged on dozens of times every day, and cops tracked him down by tracing his login. Let's check the markets. Cautionary tale about Twittering. Asian and European markets are...
If you're a hitman, I mean, it's like...
Well, true.
A hitman on Facebook. Hi, I'm a hitman. It's like, what do you expect?
Is that what he put under his...
I mean, I don't
they
know.
They do have a space to fill in your occupation.
Right, exactly. Well, that's good.
Asian and European markets are down. Futures are mixed. The Dow is now at its highest point in 18 months. It starts at 10,733. The S&P opens at 1,166. And the NASDAQ starts at 2389. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Every day we're looking for consensus on U.S. healthcare. And the industry's costs are out of control. We can all agree on that. Coverage is also available for only certain segments of society. We can agree on that. The rich are okay. The very poor have a Medicaid safety net. The elderly have Medicare. Needy children have state-administered S-CHIP programs. The middle class, though, they basically have what's jangling around in their pockets. And if you can't afford retail health insurance and you know who you are, you're on your own. Which makes it perhaps less surprising that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation finds that middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance coverage faster than any other income group. Brian Quinn joins us now. He's a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about some of the broad kind of big picture statistics in this report, but also with us is Dr. Leland Chow, who's a chief medical officer at People's Community Health Centers in Baltimore. Good morning, Dr. Chow.
Good morning.
One thing, if you could give me a sense of a person that you've encountered in your practice or in your work who's been faced with precisely the economic conditions that I've described, that costs are rising, they're unable to afford coverage, and they realize suddenly that there's really nothing out there for them as a safety net.
Absolutely. Just last week, I had a new patient who had a wonderful job prior to her becoming unemployed, and she needed to have ongoing care for chronic medical conditions. So she came to our health center and was just really grateful. But she's one of many who the face of our patients are definitely changing. It's less minority. It's definitely a different socioeconomic class. We saw 13,000 unduplicated patients last year in our network of health centers in Baltimore.
What does unduplicated patients mean?
Oh, it means that we saw them once over the past year, and 50% of them actually were uninsured, and that's definitely a greater percentage than we're accustomed.
And
15,000 showing 53,000 visits.
And these are first-timers, which means they're just entering this category, right?
Some of them are established patients, but we saw many, many new patients last year, and most of them are uninsured.
What's the sense of humiliation or change or alarm in the face of a patient like that who suddenly goes from a fabulous job and security to relying on clinics such as yourself?
Well, our mission has always been that we serve all. That's healthcare for all has always been our motto. We've been around for 40 years. However, there is a change in their primary care practice, and it's different for them. And it's something new. So when I saw this patient last week, she just broke down in tears because
Wow.
she just didn't expect to have such wonderful care, actually, in a practice that she did not anticipate providing such. So it was pretty emotionally charged for her.
Dr. Leland Chow describing the story of someone who presumably middle class discovering that they're no longer covered and without any sort of a safety net in the healthcare industry right now. Brian Quinn, you don't measure tears in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study, but there's nothing unusual about that story, is there?
Not at all. In fact, in Maryland, we found that the percent of middle-class Maryland residents with employer-sponsored coverage fell over the last decade from about 75% to 62%. And we know that, as you mentioned earlier, public insurance programs like Medicaid are not covering these middle-class populations. And so that we see big jumps in the uninsured in this population.
And so the COBRA program, which is supposed to keep people insured for some period of time after they lose their job, is really not adequate to keep people from falling off the cliff here. Is that what your study shows?
That's right. I think our study covered data through 2008, which is the most recent data you can get from the Census Bureau. And so that was before the really big downturn in the economy. It's possible that the situation could be quite a bit worse here in 2009 and 2010.
So these are COBRA programs ending, people losing their job. That's one sort of driver that's pushing this population up. But the other one, and you describe it in the report, is the actual cost of healthcare options if you have to go retail. What's that like?
That's quite right. We know there are many horror stories about people trying to buy coverage in the individual market. If you live in a state with good insurance regulations, laws that limit things like pre-existing conditions and denial of coverage and benefits, oftentimes that coverage is prohibitively expensive. In states that are unregulated, individual insurance plans can make it very difficult for people to get coverage by keeping people out who have these pre-existing conditions.
Wow. Brian Quinn, Senior Program Officer of Research and Evaluation at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Leland Chow, you're an MD, right? What's your specialty?
I'm a family physician.
Family physician. How much of your time do you have to spend advising people on insurance strategies as well as healthcare strategies?
Oh, that's an excellent question. It seems that more and more these days I'm spending several minutes of my valuable time that I have with my patients just talking about, you know, their insurance and their financial worries that they greatly impact their health. So just trying to navigate the healthcare system. Now, our sliding fee program through the federal government is fairly straightforward. We just need their documentation of inability to pay. But it certainly wears on their minds.
All right, Dr. Leland Chow, Chief Medical Officer at People's Community Health Centers in Baltimore, thanks so much for being with us. Final question for you, Brian Quinn. If you don't have health insurance in this economy in the United States, can you even say you're middle class anymore?
That's a great question, John. We've historically thought about this being a problem that really affects low-income populations, but it's clearly moving up the income ladder and starting to hit a big chunk of Americans.
You know, it's a kind of a Lou Dobbsian thing to say, but it sounds to me like there's a war on the middle class as far as healthcare reform is concerned. Brian Quinn, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. How many times has this sound awoken you early in the morning on a Saturday or Sunday and left you cursing the owner of the car? Now imagine that happening all over town, dozens of vehicles. That's what happened in Austin, Texas late last month before police arrested the person responsible, who was 20-year-old Omar Ramos Lopez. He was arrested yesterday and slapped with computer intrusion charges. Turns out he was using his home computer to set off alarms all over the city, and that's not all he was doing.
Whacking the cars with the computer.
No.
He was using the...
Yeah, he was sitting at home causing the alarms to go off, and that's not all he was doing.
That's freaky.
John Abel has been reporting on this story for Wire.com. John, welcome back.
Good morning.
So he went further than setting off alarms from his computer. What else did he do?
Well, the purpose of this sort of technology is to disable the car. This is put on cars that people with a very dodgy credit agree to have in order to get the car. And the point is, if you don't make your payment, you can't start your car. So that's what you can do with this stuff.
So he sat at his computer in his regular old web browser, and
yep,
because he had the password, he was able to not just set off car alarms, but immobilize these cars. The owners couldn't start them.
That's correct. Using the technology for exactly what the technology is meant to do, although he wasn't authorized to do that anymore and was using someone else's account. That's
why
right.
did he do this?
He was the proverbial disgruntled former employee, and he managed to convince a soon-to-be former disgruntled employee to give him his credentials. His account had been canceled, but he just thought he'd get a little payback to the company that fired him.
Okay, please tell me, John Abel, if I'm justified in being a little bit worried about this whole thing. I also hear commercials from OnStar that says they can remotely unlock my car, and it makes me nervous that somebody from some computer screen in some other state even could be messing with my vehicle.
Well, if you have dodgy credit and you don't make your payment, you have every reason to be worried. But both these kinds of things and the OnStar thing are sort of opt-in. They are opt-in.
Right.
And OnStar is actually a peace of mind sort of comfort service, because it's used to do things like open your car if you can authenticate that
you're
over the phone, right? And to slow your car down if it's been stolen, so you have a slow speed chase on the highway. Rather than never seeing your car again. And, of course, OnStar is the company that says we can find your car, we can locate your car if it's stolen. So same technology, same idea, totally different demographics.
There's nothing to be worried about in this technology that lets people remotely mess with my vehicle.
It's people that mess with technology, with people.
Oh, my God. I don't know about that, pal. That's scaring me.
Well, it's not in your car unless you agree to have it there.
Right. That's true. Yeah. But the future will be, we won't know it, right?
I doubt very much that the car industry, which is already desperate to get your business, will do anything to sabotage that.
Good point.
Okay, John,
good point.
John Abel is the New York bureau chief for Wired.com. He's talking about this case in Austin, Texas, where a disgruntled employee, basically, that's what he did. He was ticked off that he got let go.
And he remotely...
He remotely, not just set the alarm bombs, but imagine walking outside to go to work and, you know, your car doesn't start. And it's some guy sitting, you know, in his
Poltergeist.
T-shirt.
I saw that movie.
It wasn't a poster guy. It was Omar Ramos Lopez messing on his web browser. It's a weird story out of Austin.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a Tech Thursday story that is so huge.
Really?
The holy grail of technology, it's fair to say, is the search for the perfect battery.
Oh.
But it also embraces culture, economics,
I thought you were going to say time travel.
That's next. That's next week.
Okay.
All right, here's a check on leading stories at 48, coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. The earliest possibility for a House vote on health care reform is Sunday now. Democrats are still waiting for a cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. And two lawmakers apparently have joined Team Healthcare Reform yesterday. Dennis Kucinich, a Democrat from Ohio, now says he will vote in favor. And he had this message for his fellow Democrats.
Well, if I can vote for this bill, there's not many people who shouldn't be able to support it.
And apparently Representative Dale Kildee of Michigan also will be voting yes instead of no. CIA Director Leon Panetta says drone strikes on hideouts in Pakistan's border region have left al-Qaeda and the Taliban, in his view, in disarray. Panetta tells The Washington Post, we have them on the run. The paper also reports this morning that Taliban fighters more than doubled the number of homemade bombs they used against NATO forces in Afghanistan last year.
This week we heard that sex.com, the domain name, is 25 years old. Oh,
dot com.
.com, the domain name, that is 25 years old. Just that, you know, whatever, blank.
I bet sex.com was one of the first ones, though.
It was, yeah. And, you know, not surprisingly, probably one of the most valuable internet domain names ever. And it's going up for auction today. To tell us about it is Kieran McCarthy. She's author of Sex.com, One Domain, Two Men, 12 Years, and the Brutal Battle for the Jewel of the Internet's Crown. She's joining us with talk about the auction today of this domain name. So there have been huge legal battles over this, correct? One man stole it from another.
That's right. Stephen Cohen stole it from a guy called Gary Kremen. In 1995, and then they fought for about 10 years, and Gary Kremen won it back.
But he never got the money settlement that he was supposed to get.
He never got any of the $65 million that the judge awarded him at all. In fact, Stephen Cohen wired it all offshore international bank accounts to make sure he couldn't get a hold of any of the money.
Okay, so after that, he decided to sell it again. And he did.
Yeah, after he ran it for a couple of years, and then he was given an offer for about $12 million, and so he sold up.
And what happened there? Because that fell through.
Well, because they thought this was a valuable domain name, as it still is, and they offered him $12 million. So he said, well, why not? And he sold up, and they've been trying to run it and trying to make money from it ever since.
But they didn't. It's up for auction again?
Well, it was up to auction. Like I heard late last night that actually the creditors have actually postponed it by filing a Chapter 11 bankruptcy against it. So we don't know whether it will actually go to auction today or not. The very last minute move against putting it up for auction.
Okay, author Kieran McCarthy, author of Sex.com, One Domain, Two Men, 12 Years in the Brutal Battle for the Jewel of the Internet's Crown. You can withdraw, John, your bid for...
No, not interested. Not
and
interested.
Finally, Education Secretary Arne Duncan wants to link college basketball graduation rates with postseason play. He says colleges that don't graduate at least 40% of their basketball players should be banned from any postseason tournaments. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Last year, the action, returning the reaction. We got ripped and torn away. Hypnotizing power, crushing all the coward. Battery is here to stay.
Battery is here to stay. There's a cover of the Metallica song, Battery. Okay, battery stories have a hard time competing with sex.com as sexy tech stories here on Tech Thursday. But in fact, the battery is probably the most important sort of holy grail struggle of chemistry, of physics, of high technology. And it's the narrative of Harry Schlesinger, who's the author of The Battery, How Portable Power Sparked a Technological Revolution. He's here in the studio. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
You know, this is a great story, the search for a battery, something that delivers electricity on demand and you can kind of carry it around with you, goes way back, and it is a holy grail. It's not an exaggeration.
It is. The battery continues to improve, and it continues to try to catch up to technology. Batteries tend to lag a little behind the technology.
And they are a real limiting technology for all the kinds of things that we hope we're going to develop in the future. You know, wind power, photovoltaics all depend on batteries. Electric cars depend on batteries. And, of course, the digital revolution has depended on small, portable lithium-ion batteries.
Sure. But the good news is that there's many different types of batteries now, a lot of different types of chemistries, and more on the horizon, and different formats of batteries.
You know, you go back to the very, very early days of batteries, and I'm wondering if there's a pattern. We know the kinds of people who are in software development, for instance, or in aerospace, the kinds of scientists that are attracted into those fields. The battery folks, they're an unusual bunch, wouldn't you say?
They are. Going back, you know, they were mostly amateur scientists,
right,
and professors. Alexander Volta was a professor and a physics professor instruments maker. Luigi Galvini was a doctor, an anatomist in Bologna. And then we have a lot of people just fooling around with different acid bases and different metals.
Thomas Edison was one of them.
Thomas Edison was one of them. He spent about 10 years trying to develop a battery for cars.
And it didn't work out.
By the time he got something that was usable, the Model T had already taken off and become dominant for cars. He thought, and he always thought, that the gasoline, the internal combustion engine, was just an interim technology. He didn't realize how long that interim would be.
That's interesting. And again, so many people have bet on batteries and lost. As many have bet and lost as have bet and one.
That's true.
Describe to me the chemistry of batteries without getting too technical here, and we don't want people to run to their cars and drive immediately to work because we're going to talk about chemistry here. There are certain chemical configurations that produce certain voltages,
right,
and others that produce other voltages. There's a chemical reason why all carbon batteries have 1.5 volts, right?
Right. Well, the big thing, I think, the big misconception is that batteries store electricity the way a glass stores water. The truth of the matter is batteries are little power plants that produce electricity through oxidation, essentially rust, setting the electrons free.
It's basically how many electrons can be dumped off of these atoms, and you put these,
right,
chemicals together that actually are a little bit unstable,
right,
and you hold them in a kind of a equilibrium and let the electrons come out in a nice, reasonable form.
Right.
Right. But some batteries catch on fire, like, of course, the laptop batteries a few years ago.
Well, that was a design flaw or production flaw in the, you know, the idea is to get as much surface area as possible, to pack as much material as possible, and it was just packed a little bit too tight there.
For the laptops.
For the laptops.
Now, in the future, you describe at the end of this book that battery design is going to really change from a centralized, huge block, huge brick kind of power system to something that's distributed, maybe almost biological in its nature. Describe how batteries might be decentralized as power sources.
Well, we live in a portable world. Things are becoming increasingly more portable, so you're going to see a lot of different configurations. For instance, you'll see supercapacitors, which actually do hold an electric charge like most people think batteries do today.
And those, where will they be deployed?
Those might be anywhere from, you know, small devices to larger devices. But the advantage to them, to the supercapacitors, is that they charge very quickly. You'll be able to charge your cell phone in 3 or 4 seconds.
3 or 4 seconds?
Yeah.
And these batteries are also getting to be the size of cells, to be distributed like throughout the body or throughout a device.
Right. Those are nano things. Those will probably be charged wirelessly.
And what's the most surprising sort of story you determined from your exploration of the battery world?
The most surprising story was probably just how they crept along and kept going into different formats.
And do you have a favorite battery? AAA, D, C?
Probably the flat film. Flat film batteries.
Flat film batteries.
They're almost as thin as paper, so you'll be able to use them with electronic paper in the future.
All right. Henry Schlesinger chronicles the development of all kinds of battery designs in his book, The Battery, How Portable Power Sparked a Technological Revolution, which really means we should go out on Metallica, don't you think?
Absolutely.
One of your favorite songs, I can imagine.
It's in the book.
Battery's here to stay. You know, that's Metallica with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra.
And if you want to hear that interview again and hear about oxidation again, you can go to our site, thetakeaway.org. We have lots of stuff there. One thing you want to listen back to is the new report that says the middle class is losing their health care coverage faster than the rich or the poor. And that has us thinking about trade-offs in terms of health care costs. What's one health expense you'd skip and one that you absolutely have to pay for? Would you pay for a dental checkup or not? Or shell out for minor surgery or not? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. You also still have time to get your slogans in, your six-word slogans that, if you win, will end up on a T-shirt.
Check it out. Check out. There's a landslide of suggestions. You can get an update by going to our website.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.